I can't remember one single run that I enjoyed while trying to race. I feel like to be successful at anything, you need to be different from the other riders. Take someone like Loic Bruni or Jackson Goldstone. Obviously, they sell a ton of bikes and equipment, but they don't have much metrics. You know, when Loic Bruni like wins a world championship, like I bet he sells a bunch of bikes, and there's no doubt about it. But how many bikes has he sold? You don't really know. It's more difficult. Like if you can show your value, or even better, if your value is obvious and you don't even have to argue it, and brands can see your value. That's, you know, obviously that's the position you want to be in. Riding downhill, I probably prefer the e-bike. Yeah, it's something like you might not have think about it, but I bet you do it. And I think it's something that most intermediate riders don't do enough.
Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we're going to be taking you deeper than ever into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. Just a couple of quick things before we get stuck into this week's episode with Remy Metzelier. Firstly, make sure you never miss an episode by following the podcast. Just hit that follow button in your podcast app now, or you can find dedicated buttons for all the major platforms over at downtimepodcast.com/follow. You can also keep up to date with what's going on by following us on Instagram or Facebook, where we're at Downtime Podcast. If you're hungry for more downtime, then you can join the newsletter at downtimepodcast.com/newsletter for exclusive behind-the-scenes insights, mountain biking snippets, product reviews, partner offers, and more. If you want to support the show, and at this point in time I could really do with your support, then you can join our Patreon over at downtimepodcast.com/Patreon, or grab yourself some merch from downtimepodcast.com/shop. Just a quick reminder that merch is now shipping locally in both the UK and the US, which should make the US shipping cheaper than it used to be. If you prefer to watch today's episode, you can check out the podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/@downtimepodcast. I'd love it if you head over there, subscribe to the channel, and show the video some love via likes and comments. It helps the channel grow. It's also been great fun hanging out in the chat with some of you during the weekly episode premieres on the channel, so hopefully we'll see more of you there. All the links I've mentioned will be in the show notes for this episode on the website downtimepodcast.com. All right, today we're sitting down for a long overdue catch-up with mountain biking legend Remy Metzelier. In this episode, we discuss the action from Hardline Tasmania, explore the dynamic between racing and the influencer culture dominating YouTube and social media, and unravel the intricacies of collaborating with partners in the industry. Along the way, we'll also tackle the evolving landscape of enduro racing, the growing popularity of e-bikes, and glean invaluable riding tips and advice from Remy himself. So, without further ado, here's Remy Metzelier. Remy Metzelier, welcome back to the Downtime Podcast, man. It's been a little while. How's things?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been 3 years, I guess.
Yeah.
Because we first chatted when I joined Propane, which was just over 3 years ago. So it might actually be exactly 3 years.
Yeah, fair play. And we were going to record yesterday. We're actually recording on a Tuesday because there was a good ski window came in. Hey, like, how was it? You said you were going skiing with the Loic Bruni of the snow.
Yeah, basically, yeah, for listeners, when skiing with Nick McNutt, he's a buddy of mine, lives in Squamish, and, you know, one of the best skiers around. And so conditions, though, were not nearly as good as we expected. It didn't actually snow in Whistler. All the snow came in, like, before, and it was super windy, so it was actually not a great day, but I think tomorrow and Thursday are going to be the days to go, so I look forward to it.
Good stuff. Yeah, it's been a rough season in Whistler for snow, hey?
It's, yeah, when you're on the gondola, you can, you know, see the other side of the valley where like some of the enduro track were for the EWS, and I bet you could ride some of them, like the lower part, wow. Which is completely abnormal for a month of February, end of February. Yeah. And it's been like that the entire season, basically. We got, you know, some snow at some point and then heavy rain, so everything melted, and yeah, it's pretty sad, but I guess the biking is good, so that's,
well, yeah, at least that's the silver lining to the cloud. I wanted to kick off chatting a little bit about Hardline. We had our first ever non-Welsh Hardline recently in Medina. Did you get the chance to watch the coverage?
Yeah, definitely looked at it. It looked awesome. I mean the staff, trail builders, like organization, everybody did an amazing job. Obviously, the riders, you know, rode insanely well. as expected, because it's, you know, top of the top. But the course looked incredible. And, you know, I think it's, I mean, from what I've heard and from what I've seen, everybody was super, super happy about the track and about everything. So it's awesome. And definitely got me stuck to get on my bike and do some jumps and some downhills. So.
Good. That's good to hear. I think, yeah, the riders, the problem was the riders are so good that it sort of made it not look super hard. Like, no doubt, I probably wouldn't be able to ride the vast majority of the track and none of the big features, but they're so good, that lot now, that it just, it's very hard, I think, for the TV product to like translate just how significant some of that track was.
Yeah, and like, it's, you know, it's always the same. Like, there's a difference between a big jump where the running is easy, where you can see the landing, where the landing is long, where there is no, you know, if you were to overshoot and kind of lose control, you had enough time to regain like control on your bike before the next corner or the next feature. So that's one thing. But you know, some of the jumps that were probably the hardest were the technical section, and this in camera like never shows, right? So one of them was a left-hander, and you are coming on a black, like a completely blind right-hander, and it was like a wooden takeoff, like going downhill. And yeah, most of the rider were like on the very far edge of the wood and, you know, kind of reaching for the landing. And this, like, camera doesn't show, but any, you know, any advanced rider would notice that if the rider come in cornering, like what would cross your mind is, you know, what if I slide on the takeoff? Like, it's not even the jump itself. It's like before the jump, you know, what if I come in a tiny bit too wide and I'm not able to, you know, stay on the wood and, you know, I drift on the outside and then, you know, either I don't make it to the landing and I land too far left, or I slide on the takeoff. And all of that obviously doesn't really show in camera. But, you know, I'm sure that was probably the trickiest part of the track.
Yeah, fair play. And it was cool to see like almost all the riders come away healthy, which doesn't always happen at a hard line. And it was also cool to see a couple of the women run top to bottoms in the race run, which was super cool. Do you feel like that makes hardline potentially more likely to succeed as like a series alongside the World Cups? Like, it feels now that if you know you could go to hardline and kind of come away from it in one piece, like it's no more risky maybe than a World Cup, then maybe we'll see more riders doing it. We'll see it standalone as a series a bit more.
Oh, I think like hardline has the potential to become like, you know, the type of events that people really look forward to and like really follow. I think there's a lot of media coverage and I think it's more interesting. Right? I mean, obviously I'm a fan of the sport and, you know, I follow all the World Cups. Like I know the results pretty well. Like, you know, I pay attention and I feel like I'm really connected to the scene. But I feel like hardline has the potential to reach out to a wider public. A little bit like supercross and motocross, where,
yeah,
you know, motocross is probably more for the hardcore fans. So that would be like World Cup. And hardline could be a bit more like the supercross, where anybody can be, you know, watching it and, you know, understands like really big jump and big features. And, you know, just making it to the bottom is already impressive. Whereas the World Cup, you just assume that everybody's going to make it to the bottom. And obviously riders have to go fast, but, and the tracks are, you know, very difficult and, you know, it's really hard to do a top to bottom. But it doesn't show nearly as well on TV because the features are not very impressive. So unless you ride a mountain bike, you don't really realize that a rock garden that's, you know, slightly wet, even if on camera that looks good, can be extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Whereas hardline with a big feature, you know, I think everybody understands like, wow, that feature is like as tall as a three-story building. You know, everybody's been on a three-story building and looked onto the streets. And so I think people understand really well, wow, this is really big, this is really gnarly.
Yeah, no, totally. I agree with you, man. Do you see yourself racing hardline at any point? Is it something you'd like to take part in?
So I have been invited to hardline in Europe for, uh-huh, you know, for a number of years. I've never been because it conflicted too much with Rampage. I saw, you know, Rampage as like the top of the sport in terms of coverage and in terms of sponsorship opportunity. And Hardline at the beginning was always in September. So right before Rampage. And I just didn't think it was worth it. Obviously, I know it's a downhill track and, you know, it's a race. And I knew I won't be super competitive on it. It would be fun, you know, to ride the course on the jumps, but I won't be competitive on it. But now the one in Australia, obviously I haven't raced a downhill bike since, like, first of all, it was never like my thing to race a downhill bike. But also I haven't done it in 6-7 years. So if I did go to Hardline, my objective would not be to, you know, put down the time, but really having fun on the bike. I think it's, you know, the type of some of the technical section, some of the technical gap is stuff that I enjoy doing. I like to be precise on the bike. That fast section in the middle is, you know, something that's looked incredibly fun, you know, going this fast and doing those jumps. And, you know, obviously the big jumps at the bottom, it's a pretty unreal feeling. So I think it's definitely something I'd be interested in checking out for sure, but with no expectation whatsoever to, you know, do any type of performance, but just really wanting to have fun on it.
Yeah, that's fair, man. And it feels like you've kind of, in recent years, I guess, sort of stepped away from the competition element of riding. Is that fair? Was that like a conscious decision to focus on other things?
Yeah, it's never been like, well, there's different reasons, but bigger thing, I've never enjoyed it. Even like, you know, local races or like, I feel like I'm very competitive, but not in that time, not on a bike. You know, going as fast as I can for 3 minutes or, you know, 5 minutes for me actually removes the fun of biking because you have to be on the edge. And I find like the risk increases drastically. And it's not a position I like to be in. I like to push my riding, but on my terms while being like very focused. And it's not something I enjoyed. Like, it's, you know, as soon as the clock starts and as soon as you start, like, I can't remember one single run that I enjoyed while trying to race. It's like a good feeling, you know, when you cross the finish line and you feel proud of yourself, like you rode well. And I had a few urban downhill races where I did well. Like I won a few where there was, you know, like some solid competition, like Bernard Kerr, Thomas Lavig, Bernardo Cruz. But like the only fun part I had was, you know, crossing the finish line and knowing that I'd done a great run and feeling proud of myself. But during the run itself, it's, you know, I just don't like the feeling of being on the edge. And if you want to be competitive, you have to be on the edge.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's hard for us probably to contemplate, like, when we watch your videos, the level of riding is so high and the features are so kind of extreme for most of us that I think it's hard for us to feel we could ride like that in a comfort zone. Do you know what I mean? Like, I guess we just assume you're always pushing.
But I'm always pushing, like I'm always on the edge, but it's a few seconds. So like your focus within those few seconds can be super high. Whereas on a race, you have to be focused for 3-4 minutes, but also you have to be focused at training. Like, you have to be Jackson Goldstone when he's riding in Squamish and doing downhill laps. He might not be pushing as much as on a World Cup track. And, you know, I'm confident he's pushing really hard, but he also does like a bunch of laps top to bottom where he's pushing all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's never a position that I've enjoyed.
Okay. Yeah, fair. No, fair comment. I wanted to talk about the YouTube side of things, obviously, with you. And I'm interested in whether you feel like you went after that kind of content-focused career path or whether it sort of found you. Because obviously you went through the video projects with like all the Whistler gaps and stuff, and that, I guess, is kind of what kicked it off. But when would you say you actually consciously started to go after like the YouTube career path? Because it's been super good for you, I think
it was a way to like almost give back to like the community on you know, what I've learned and find a way to be able to share that with people. So obviously there's some projects that are like, you know, really selfish, where it's just me writing and me trying to make, you know, some gaps and stuff. But a lot of it is trying to share tips, and those tips are, you know, very useful to people, right? Like the last couple of videos that I've put out, the comments are, you know, thanks a lot, this was really helpful. Well, you know, I'm going to try to apply that on my local trails and see if that helps me to ride better. And so that was kind of the idea. And obviously, I think, and it was always the reason behind, but from a business perspective with sponsor, I think that was very valuable. And that's, you know, the big reason of why I'm doing it is because people like it. As a result, sponsor like it. Obviously, it's good visibility for their products. And, you know, I think that was almost like a market where there's not many pro riders that do that. So I feel like to be successful at anything, you need to be different from the other riders, whatever the sport you're doing. And so I felt like this was for me a way to have my own niche in a way.
Yeah, and it's worked, right? You've grown a couple of big YouTube channels now, and there's more and more people kind of pushing into that area and trying to do that kind of stuff. What would you say are the key things that have enabled you to succeed? Like one of them, I guess, is what you just alluded to, the fact that you've positioned yourself differently to anyone else. But like, what areas would you say have really helped you succeed in growing those big channels?
You know what? It's difficult to answer because I feel like, I mean, I've been on YouTube for a while, and I feel like I know what can be successful, but then there's a big difference in whereas I'm willing to do what I need to be successful at it or not. And a lot of it to me is a bit off brand. So like, you know, when you watch some of the videos that works, like usually the thumbnails are quite clickbaity, so are the titles. And, you know, sometimes I do it because unfortunately, if you don't do it, the algorithm just doesn't show your video. The way the algorithm like shows your video and basically determines how successful is going to be a video is based on a few elements. One of them is how many people are going to click on the thumbnail. And that has nothing to do with the quality of the video. Your video could be, you know, a black screen from top to bottom or like start to finish, I guess. But you have a really attractive thumbnail and title, your click-through rate is going to be high. And that's something where I've always struggled at. My click-through rate aren't good because my titles and my thumbnail don't really attract much people. And that's something that's always, you know, always difficult. But I guess I've always focused on the writing itself and the tips inside the video and not, you know, basically I focused on the product and not on the marketing of the product, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely something that I would need to improve, but it's not an element that I, you know, enjoy doing. So I, you know, focus on what I like to do instead of the stuff that I should be doing to be more successful at it. And then there's different elements like how long people are watching the content and, you know, all that stuff. But I find a lot of the videos that are the most viewed are in fact the least valuable for sponsors. Yeah. So, you know, yes, a video can get a ton of views, but if it's not really in line with your brand and with the product you promote, then your value for sponsor isn't actually that amazing, even though you've got great views. Often the videos that are the most valuable for partners are the ones that get the least amount of views, mostly because they target to like a really core audience. Mm-hmm. And so it's always, you know, it's always a fine balance to find. And so I try to detach myself from the actual stats and actual number from YouTube. And most importantly, I want to do something that, you know, I feel proud of and I enjoy, and that's helping people to, you know, enjoy their riding experience better and, you know, get a better appreciation of the products they are riding and how they can improve it. And so that's what I've been after.
Yeah. And I guess like you're in a slightly different position to some YouTubers. Like some people purely rely on the revenue from YouTube ads, whereas I would assume you get paid by the brands that you know, support you, that you work with, and that you do effectively, I guess, promotional stuff for. Like, how have you gone about building those relationships, right? Because it's super important, but it's also very complex, and, you know, bringing those brands on board and helping them understand what you can do for them is not straightforward. And I think I'm right in saying you've always done that yourself. Like, you don't use an intermediary or a manager or anyone like that.
Yeah, I do it myself for what I think the main reason is I enjoy it. I really enjoy, like, working with brands, you know, building a relation, but also maintaining the relationships. Because, you know, building them is cool, but, you know, if it only lasts 1 year, it's not super interesting. So it's like building, but then maintaining over the years. And that's why, for the most part, you know, I keep partners for a very long time. Since we did the podcast 3 years ago, I basically have every partner the same except a couple, but, you know, things evolve, obviously. But for the most part, you know, it's something I've really enjoyed. And I think with YouTube, that was a good way to, I guess, make the relationship evolve at the same time as my career. Was, you know, if you've gone from, like, competing and then you do something completely different without proper plans, and, you know, you might not be able to keep relationships going because people sign you for something, and if you switch to something different without being able to communicate with partner on, you know, why it's going to be beneficial for them, or, you know, if they don't see it, then obviously you can continue those relationships. So.
Yeah, I was going to ask, actually, what do you see, like, themes between relationships for you that have lasted a long time and relationships that have maybe only lasted, like, 1 year? Are there certain things that you can sense in a relationship quite quickly, or does it vary?
You know, like, sometimes relationships end with partners, and there is absolutely nothing wrong. You know, product was great. Relationship with a partner was great. Communication was great. Everything was on brand, but another opportunity came in that makes more sense, either for the brand or for the rider. So, you know, when you see on Pink Bike and Vital Mountain Bike, and, you know, like, the team rumors, like, people always assume that something wrong happened, but, you know, a lot of the time, absolutely nothing wrong happened. And it's, you know, you just found a new opportunity that's going to make more sense for your career long term, you know, something that's more exciting, and then it makes sense to change. And it can be the same for the brand, you know, been working with the same rider for a while, and, you know, there is a new team that becomes available, or a new rider, and it's going to be maybe more beneficial for the brand. And so that's, you know, I think that's pretty normal, but people often assume something bad happens. Which, you know, can happen, but I think it's wrong to assume that.
Yeah. And I guess, like, just, you probably put a lot of effort into those relationships once you have them, I guess, like, maintaining contacts and keeping everyone up to date with what's going on. It's not like, oh, here's some money and some kit, like, see you later.
Yeah, well, it's much easier to maintain a relationship than to build a new one. Okay. You know, so it's like, what you've got a partner, and you know, I assume it's the same for you, right? Like, you have, you know, a few partners, mm-hmm. and, you know, you make a podcast, they see return on investment, they're happy. It's easier for you to maintain that relationship and get, you know, Shimano, Fox, or whatever brand to sponsor on your podcast. It's probably easier to do so than it is to go and reach out to a new brand and have to prove, you know, your worth to this brand and how you align best with the company and how, what you can bring to their, you know, to their marketing, to their product. So it's always easier, I think, to maintain a relationship, but it's definitely some work, and consistency is super important.
Yeah, for sure, man. And I think one of the big things, which is a benefit with YouTube that I think brands love, is the ability to measure it, right? You can give great data on views, watch time, and you can use affiliate codes as well, where they can kind of see a direct impact on sales. Like, how important has all that stuff been for you?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like, the, you know, numbers, it doesn't mean everything, obviously. Take someone like Loic Brunin or Jackson Gulston. Obviously, they sell a ton of bikes and equipment, but they don't have much metrics. You know, when Loic Brunin, like, wins a world championship, like I bet he sells a bunch of bikes. And there's no doubt about it, but how many bikes has he sold? You don't really know. It's a bit the same though with YouTube. When you know you got codes and links, the number of times someone has clicked on the link is not an accurate representation of the number of time you actually had, you know, an impact on potential sales or, you know, website traffic. Because a lot of people don't click on those links. I mean, myself, if I watch a ski video or a surfing video, I very rarely go in the description to check the product. You know, if I watch a video and I recognize the brand, I usually go on the website directly without using the links. So it's not accurate either. And that's, you know, obviously a conversation that I always have with partners. It's like, also it depends on how much you want to push those links. And it's something I try to dissociate myself a little bit. And I want to make sure that people enjoy the content and then become curious about the product I write, mm-hmm. because they feel like, you know, it works for me, so it might be a good solution for them. But also with YouTube lately, you know, with those algorithm change, I find like there's a difference between the views and the actual impact you have mm-hmm. on a certain market. You know, especially with the YouTube Shorts, you can overnight have millions of views on a short that brings you X amount of subscribers. But realistically, those people, those new subscribers, like don't know anything about your sport, anything about what you promote, any of the brand you're running. So those views are very, you know, like you have to take them with a pinch of salt, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a complex picture, hey? Like with YouTube changing things and, like you say, waiting shorts really favorably, like pushing shorts more organically than maybe other videos. And also, I think they're changing, like watch time is becoming more and more important to them because that means they can sell more adverts and make more money. Like, I've got this worry that the algorithms sort of force people, and I guess you've alluded to it a little bit earlier, they sort of force people to create content to please the algorithms rather than creating the content that people want to create. So potentially it like stifles creativity and everything becomes a little bit similar. Like, what are your thoughts on that? I guess you're in a position where, because you've already got a large following, you've already got a decent amount of people seeing what you put up anyway. So it's not like you don't need to grow in the same way maybe that other channels do. But does it worry you? I feel like you don't really want to water down your content or change your content.
Like, I feel like so those numbers are important, but at the end of the day, like brands, it's like most of my incomes come from sponsorship. The YouTube part, like, you know, is very minimal. So like my incomes on YouTube, I've taken a break during the winter. I've posted much less. So my monthly income from YouTube, I've basically been divided by two. Okay. But it's, since it's, you know, fairly small amount of my income, for me, it doesn't really matter. But people, you know, who rely heavily on YouTube and, you know, mostly make money from YouTube ads, obviously are much more impacted and have to adapt even more than I do. But, you know, when working with brands, I think and that's the same for most of the providers, brands are paying for an association with a rider, and you know, they pay to use the name. And I think being a provider, like whoever you are, if you've done, you know, 10 years of World Cup and got a bunch of podiums, if you're a free rider, been to Rampage several times, or if you're a video guy that, you know, post bangers after bangers, like that's what brand pay for, is that association and using the content. So the YouTube side of it is, for me, like it's more like a bonus. It's a way for brands to get visibility, but I don't think it's not the main value that I think I bring to a partner.
Yeah, fair. Do you think it helps having so obviously there's the like the brand value in having you ride in their products, but you can add on top of that compared to what a lot of athletes can, and you can say, well, look, here's the uses of an affiliate code, here's the video views, here's this kind of stuff. So there's more measurables that you can bring to a company. Do you think that that helps things? It feels like racing and athletes often don't have that. There are a few that do bits and pieces around the racing, but often they don't have it. And I feel like that's potentially making things harder for them, especially when there's less money within the industry.
For sure. I think, you know, only thing that you can quantify is you can use it to your advantage. You know, any activation and, you know, I heard, for example, from your podcast that you had done a code, I think, with 7Mesh. And they,
yeah.
I mean, that was years ago, or a couple of years ago. But I think they were really pleased with the number. So, and it's the same for me. If I do any type of activation and I get, you know, some type of code or a link, and suddenly the brand can measure, well, our traffic has increased a lot. We got a bunch of orders. Obviously, I'm going to use it to my advantage to, you know, to make sure that that relationship goes strong and goes even stronger for the future.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's a big growth in this like YouTube area, and it's not just athletes like yourself. Like there's podcasts like me doing it. There's lots of people, to use the term influencers, I guess, kind of coming in. And there's more and more places for brands to spend money. Like, do you worry about racing kind of getting left behind in all of this? Because it's much harder for brands to measure and to attribute to, or do you think it's safe because of the fact that people love it?
I think downhill racing is in a good spot. But sadly, enduro, as we know, is in a pretty bad position, which I think is sad because the sport of enduro, or like racing enduro, is actually what people do in the weekends. I mean, here in Squamish or anywhere, people pedal to the top of the hill and they want to have fun on the downhill. You see people, you know, trying to progress, trying to go faster. And they have the exact same use of the bikes than enduro racer do, right? Like enduro racer have a bike that allows them to pedal up and go down as fast as possible. They might run, you know, downhill casing tire with Kush core for added performance and, you know, to make sure that the bike is more reliable. Whereas a regular user most likely does not need downhill casing tire and does not need, you know, necessarily Kush core. If you're riding, you know, at a moderate pace up and you just have fun on the downhill, you can get away with a lighter setup. But the type of bikes that most people are buying these days are directly what enduro racers are using and promoting when they're racing. So it's kind of sad to see the state of the sport slowing down. And that's, I think that's because, you know, government bodies haven't found a way to make enduro attractive to the public. If it was interesting to, like if it was more interesting to watch or easier to watch, I guess the number would be way up and the sport would be in a better position. But, you know, seeing like the top riders going at insane speed down, you know, super technical trails, to me is very impressive. And that's what I enjoy watching that. But I think the coverage on why is it TVs and race recaps and stuff don't really make it interesting enough that people want to really follow close the action, and therefore brands, you know, are showing less support, and sadly it's gonna be very tough for racers, at least in enduro.
It's a real shame to see some really good riders without deals, like, you know, it felt like overnight. And I guess it's a bit of a perfect storm, right? The coverage last year was probably not as extensive as maybe it has been in the past. So that felt like it stepped backwards. But also the industry, and I'm sure you've felt this to some extent, like there is less money in the industry and people are looking to save wherever they can in some instances to keep businesses alive, right? It's, it's hard for a lot of athletes, I think.
For sure. And, you know, especially during those times where it's more difficult, like if you can show your value, or even better, if your value is obvious and you don't even have to argue it, and brands can see your value, that's, you know, obviously that's the position you want to be in. But with enduro, it's gonna be interesting, and I think it's a shame because, you know, I enjoy watching it, and You know, that's a little bit like enduro moto, where everybody knows supercross and motocross, but most of the people would never put foot on a supercross track, because unless you're a professional rider, you basically can't even ride around the track. Yeah. Motocross is, you know, anyone can ride around the track, but enduro is what most people actually do. And yet the sport of enduro is so much smaller. So it's so much bigger, but the money is significantly smaller than in motocross. Yeah. Like the investment from the brands is just tiny. And yet that's what people do. So I think that's kind of the same. And, you know, maybe a company like Red Bull can find a way to make enduro interesting again and, you know, create like a, you know, a super elite league. And, maybe the sport of moto can have a positive influence on the biking and biking can, you know, see what works for hard enduro moto, for instance, and, you know, bring it to the sport of cycling and see if we can make something happen with that.
Yeah, it'd be good to see. Do you think we'll see more of those riders turning towards things like YouTube to like create some self-promotion? And like, I think like what Jack Moyer's done with Moy Moy TV has been super good. Like, not only has he covered some really good trackside stuff from the Downhill World Cup, but I think he's given some really good insight into the Enduro World Series or Enduro World Cup as it is now that was kind of missing before, right? And we didn't really get that vibe as to what was going on.
Well, the problem is that it's, I think he does an amazing job, but it takes a lot of time and effort. So if you focused on your, you know, you go and race, so I think they show up to the track on Wednesday, kind of walk around. Thursdays they've got practice. Fridays they might have, you know, a couple of stages. Saturday a stage. Sundays the rest of the stage. It doesn't give you much time to, you know, edit and do all that work to, you know, keep up with all those platforms nowadays. It's really difficult to do that, as well as, you know, recovering, studying your GoPro footage so you can, you know, rewatch the track over and over to, you know, learn, see a line you might have missed, you know, then go over the bike and, you know, all the stuff they got to do. It's really hard to do that plus the YouTube side of things, unless you have someone that does it for you. And yeah, there's a problem that there's not enough money in the sport to have someone in contract that's going to be following you around, you know, 6 months of the year when you're racing to produce content for you. I think downhill teams are able to do that because there is much more money. So a downhill team can have that. And I think it makes sense for the top rider to, someone like Loic Bruni can afford to have someone making like daily vlogs during the World Cup. But most enduro racers don't make enough of a living to be able to pay that.
Yeah, it's like a bit of a downward spiral, hey? It's hard to see how you break that spiral, but then, and drag it out of it.
And then it's, you know, it's always the same. It's an investment. Rider has to pay, you know, to pay for a filmer and an editor, which obviously is expensive, and you spend, you know, for a season $50,000-$80,000. Are you gonna make that money back with sponsorship deals? It's, you know, it's always a gamble, right?
Yeah, for sure. It's a tricky one. How are you feeling about the state of the industry at the moment? Like, obviously, you've got a good pulse check on things. You work with a lot of brands. It feels like I went to a trade show last week, and it was the most positive vibe I've felt from the industry for a while. Like, it feels like maybe things are starting to improve, but what are you seeing over there?
Yes, that's also what I think. Like, I've been lucky, like, with the partner I've been working with, seems like everybody's doing fine. The conversations that I've had with brands are, you know, pretty positive. Obviously, you know, you open Pink Bike and Vital and, you know, you see bad news everywhere. And, but I think things are getting better. Things are starting to get better now.
Good.
So
yeah,
I'm expecting at least stuff to be like more stable. You know, there's less unknown. And, you know, obviously some brands are doing much better than others. But I feel like by now, if your brand is stable, at least it should continue being stable, and you know, you've probably passed the hardest point. Obviously, yeah. If right now you're in a tough position, it's hard to get better from a low point. So yeah, we'll see. It's pretty interesting, but I do think things are getting in a positive trajectory.
Yeah, and it feels like e-bikes have been a big part of that. Like they're propping up a lot of brands. I think it's one of the only real areas that's growing. Yeah. What are your thoughts on e-bikes? I've seen you've been playing around a little bit with them.
My favorite bike right now is my e-bike. Like it's a lattice bike from Propane.
Yeah.
Meaning, obviously, being the newest bike, it's, you know, the lattice, you know, geometry and the lattice technology. So obviously, it's expecting that it's gonna be my favorite bike. But yeah, I absolutely love what the bike can do. Like, there's no longer any. You don't have to slow down because you're on an e-bike anymore. You know, some of the older e-bike, because of the design, you couldn't drop your seat post had to be at a certain height, so you had to use like a shorter travel post. But now, you know, manufacturers have found a way to integrate the motor and the battery a way that no longer affects the suspension platform of the bike or the seat post height. So now you can run your seat post the same way you run it on your regular trail bike. Propane is using the same suspension platform that they have used on the other bikes. So now you can get, you know, they basically managed to make a bike, despite the fact that it's an e-bike and it's got a battery and motor, they were able to, you know, build the kinematic and the suspension the same way they would have built a regular bike. So they didn't have to make any compromise, basically. That's how I should have phrased it. Like, there's no more any compromise on the bike itself because it's an e-bike. So that means you can basically get the most amount of performance of the actual bike in terms of how it rides downhill while having, you know, a motor on the battery. Yeah. And
has that got the new SRAM motor system in it?
Yeah, I've got the new SRAM powertrain. But Propane also has one. They also have the aluminium version of the Icano. So it's the Icano 2 CF. So the carbon version comes with the SRAM powertrain system, whereas the aluminium version, which is very similar looking, but obviously it's aluminium, and it comes with a Shimano EP8 motor.
Got you. How is that SRAM powertrain? Because that's got all kinds of like auto shift functions and technology on it.
So I don't have any affiliation whatsoever with SRAM or Shimano. So I could choose any of the two bikes. I chose the SRAM one because it was new. So I was like, you know, thought it was something like more exciting. And the bike was carbon. I do really like the feel of the carbon versus the aluminium. And it's, you know, it's the higher end. So obviously to choose from, may as well go for the most expensive one, right? But I've been super surprised. Like the biggest thing for me, obviously the power. The motor is powerful, but manageable. It's not super snappy. So when you pedal up technical stuff, you don't get surprised by how much power the bike has. You know, you don't suddenly like wheelie up something without wanting it. So I find it very smooth to pedal up. But when you ride down, it's completely silent. There's no noise, no chain rattles, no like battery flopping. And I think, so when you ride down, it's, you know, basically you ride on a normal bike that's heavier. And I really like the weight. Like going downhill, having the weight, like, so the bike is 23 kilos, which is considered as a heavier e-bike, but obviously it's more powerful. But I absolutely love how it stays online. And when you get onto like, especially because that's my strength on the bike, I find is moving the bike around. So being able to place the bike in the air or on the ground so I can hold the lines. But my weakness of the bike is probably the high speed commitments and like holding like certain lines that are like a bit bumpy. And I find like the weight of the e-bike actually helps me to overcome, I guess, my weaknesses when I ride.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really impact my strength. So I can still move the bike, you know, exactly the same way as on a regular bike.
Yeah. How much of your riding hours would you say you spend, like what percentage of time do you spend on e-bikes these days?
When I first got the e-bike, I exclusively rode that e-bike for the, you know, until I crashed, because I had a crash on the bike. But until I crashed, I basically rode that e-bike exclusively.
Wow. I was going to ask you about crashing.
Yeah, I had so much fun on that bike. That's all I rode for an entire month.
Fair play. What about now? What's the split kind of? Is it like 50-50 normal bike versus e-bike or?
So like a day like today, I'm going to go and ride my regular bike because I have something specific in mind that I want to film. I've already filmed it, but I wasn't super happy with the light because it was sunny and the footage didn't look as good as what it should look today because today is overcast. Okay. So I'm going to go back to do that. And following that, I'll probably go and ride the e-bike. So once I'll be tired from riding my regular bike, just because I'm going to have to hike up a bunch, I'll probably go and with the e-bike I rode is one of my favorite trails here in Squamish. I believe it's 650 meters of elevation or 670 maybe. It's like the total drop and it takes me 25 or 26 minutes to get to the top. If I shuttle, so if I put the bike in the car, go to the top, the driving time is 13 minutes. But the time to put the bike on the bike rack, remove the bike off the bike rack, obviously drive on the car, and that doesn't even make sense. So with the e-bike, I just get a good workout because I'm still pushing. But you get that. I probably like put the same watts than I would if I was pedaling the bike, but it's just a better feeling because you get more speed, it's more consistent. You can be very consistent with how you pedal, and I enjoy it much more. I think it's like, it's almost like the feeling of pedaling a road bike on like a consistent, like a slight uphill, you know, where you can be very consistent and still feel like you're actually moving. Whereas pedaling a regular mountain bike, obviously not moving very fast, unless you need no shorter or whatever. But so that's why I really enjoy my bike. It makes the uphill fun. And riding downhill, I probably prefer the e-bike. You know, it's more stable. You know, you don't get deflected as much when you hit like a weird rock or anything like this. And I find I've got more confidence. The bike is a bit longer as well than my other bikes. So I do really, really enjoy it.
Very nice, very nice. Was the crash you had on that the one like on that compression?
Yeah, so I actually just did a video where I explained what happened, but I was riding.
I watched that today. It made me want to talk a bit about crashing because I kind of.
I
assume that you don't really want to crash because you can't then work. Like, there's a risk for you there.
Yeah, so that's it's funny. Like, because any sport I do now, I am way more cautious than I was before. Like skiing, you know, even surfing, like. Riding moto, anything I do, like so the risk level is, I really lower the risk level and, you know, there's a bunch of stuff I could do, but I just no longer do them because obviously I don't want to get hurt because I enjoy riding my bike, but I also enjoy skiing and any other sport. And obviously if I'm injured, I can't do any of that. So first of all, if I'm injured and, you know, for 6 weeks, 3 months or whatever, I can't do the stuff I love anymore. But obviously it's got an impact on my income. You know, I'm lucky to have great sponsor, and you know, if I break my scaphoid, no one is gonna cut my salary. But you know, obviously I would feel that I'm not able to deliver as much as I promised, and surely it will have a negative impact on the future. Fortunately, with YouTube and with what I do, I can find ways around. Like I could probably do a video where, you know, I take another rider and we go on a track and maybe I help them to progress without me riding. So I'm still able to bring a value for sponsors, but obviously I don't want to get hurt at all. So I usually am very, very calculated on what I do. But that day I crashed on the e-bike, that was end of November. I, you know, I think I was running really well. And I knew the track by heart. It's Jackson Colston and some of his buddies that have built that the track, and it's awesome. It's got a bunch of little gaps. Nothing is too big. You know, there's nothing extremely technical, but there is that one roller. If you go at a medium speed, you roll the compression, or you can potentially jump into that compression. But it's a bit awkward. And when you go fast, it becomes dangerous. So when you go fast, you actually have to commit and jump over it. And, you know, the first time I saw that, to me, it was pretty obvious that you should be jumping the compression because it's a better line or better rhythm, I guess. And, you know, first time I've done it, things went perfectly. And then, you know, I did more laps. And so I was going faster and faster. And I was actually filming a GoPro video, and every little clip I post like that on social media, I'm really pushing my riding. Like, I'm not just pressing play and or record and just going through the track. I'm trying to ride at the highest level I can. And I kept on going back because I was like, I can ride better. But I usually would make mistake toward the bottom of the track, because even though it's a short track, you know, you start getting tired, and in the winter it's really cold. And so my vision was what was affecting me the most. Okay. Not really my fitness, like really my vision. Because if I go with a full face helmet, I just don't have the same feeling. And on the trail bike, you know, when it's 3 degrees out there, like your eyes are watery a bit more than they are in the summer. And I find like I was struggling with my vision towards the bottom of the track. Like, it's pretty dark. And anyway, so I usually would make mistakes towards the bottom of the... And the mistake, like, you know, there would be mistakes that you would not even be able to tell on camera. But I know that, you know, I tap my brakes a bit too much, or I slow down in the corner instead of before the corner. I didn't feel like I carried the speed out of a corner properly. But that upper part, I was super dialed. Like, I felt like I could make no mistakes. And I was pushing, going as fast as I could. And I ended up over jumping very slightly that little double prior to the compression that caused me to miss actually the roller, where you had to like absorb and preload to pull the bunny up. And so as a result, I basically missed the timing. I still did the gap because I had to, and I thought I would be completely fine. I kind of cased it a little bit on the front wheel, but something that was insignificant. But the track is super, super tight, and there's trees all over the place. And when I cased it, I went offline, but we're talking about, you know, this much, like less than 10 centimeters, but that was enough to clip my hand on a tree. So I clipped my hand on the tree, and they just sent me to the side, like, you know, right away. There's nothing I could do. And honestly, I got very lucky that it wasn't much worse.
Yeah, you got a pretty nasty hematoma, right?
Yeah, I got a hematoma. I honestly thought I'd shattered my pelvis at first. I got very lucky because where I impacted is where there's your hip or your pelvis. I guess it's your hip. And my physio was pretty impressed that I didn't break it, because I impacted right, just like a centimeter above the actual bone. I separated my shoulder. Uh-huh. Which was a shame, because I usually separate this one, but this one I've been fine so far, so now I feel like I'm balanced. But you know, all of this recovered really well. Definitely hit my lower back, and all the muscles were super tight, and my wrist. I did damage my wrist, but it's funny because I smacked the tree with my right hand, crashed on the left. But I think what damaged my wrist is my bars. Just when I took the tree, it just like. And yeah, I did a bunch of x-rays and stuff, and apparently nothing broken, but it's still bothering me a little bit. It doesn't, like, I can obviously ride, I've got full mobility, but it's definitely getting better. So, but it was annoying.
Do you find it hard to move beyond things like that? I mean, obviously you've been back and I've seen the video of you clearing it, getting it all dialed, but like, do you find it hard to move beyond a big crash that almost came out of nowhere like that and get back up to confident pace, or is it just so natural?
No, I think it was pretty natural, but I couldn't ride fast anyway because of my wrist and my shoulder. So, you know, it's not like I had the crash and then when you go back, you feel 100%. I wasn't feeling super good, like body-wise. My wrist was holding me back anyway. So I couldn't get back straight to speed anyway. So I think that was almost for the best, because that way I had to rebuild slowly that confidence in order to be able to ride fast again.
Yeah, yeah. So on the content side of things, I'm interested in like how you approach keeping it fresh, because there's only so many sort of skills and things you can teach people. Obviously, there's always, I guess, new lines and new gaps to show in the stuff that, like you said, is more for you maybe and less to help people out sort of thing. But like how do you go about planning what you're going to do and trying to keep things fresh and keep putting out new material? Because, yeah, it must be a challenge.
Yeah, I definitely lack on the planning side. You know, like mountain biking is like the rules of how to ride a bike are not that complicated. You know, it's often the same, like looking ahead, like, and it applies to anybody, right? But, you know, thinking that you look ahead, making sure that your braking points are correct. And those are like constant reminder. And I bet, you know, the top World Cup racer, when they train, they still focus on those things, you know, to, in order to go faster and to ride better. Like they try to brake later and harder and focus and carry speed out of the corner. And so it's like a never ending circle. And it's more like making sure that you can remind it to people every single time. So it, you know, it basically gets anchored in people's mind. And, okay, those are like the main point I should be thinking every time I'm riding my bike. And it's, you know, it's like that whether you are getting into the sport or you are intermediate, advanced or professional. And so I feel like it's, you know, for the YouTube videos, it's always going to be about reminding skills. Cause you know, it's not really like doing a trick where you go from not knowing how to do a bar spin to learning. Cornering, like everybody, like anybody can corner on the street, right? So then it's like how you apply it to the trails and how you make sure that your cornering technique is, you know, getting better. And once it's really good, you can always, once it's really good, you can always make sure it's getting better on different type of corner. And then you make sure that it's consistent. And once it's consistent, you make sure that you corner faster, etc. I think it's a never ending thing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes total sense. And like I always assumed that there's only so much you can be told about a lot of these things. But then I watched your line choice video today and something came up in that I'd never thought about or heard before. And you would, which kind of interested me. You were talking about the difference between an attack position and a neutral position and how you might use the two, like, and how a downhiller maybe spends more time in the attack position because they know where they're going, whereas an enduro rider might spend a bit more time in the neutral position because they need to look up better. Can you just talk about that a little bit? Because I thought it was quite an interesting concept for people.
Yeah, it's something like you might not think about it, but I bet you do it, right? If you ride a trail for the first time, you're definitely more cautious, you're standing higher on your bike and you're looking ahead more. But when it's your local trail and you know it by heart, naturally you are attacking more, right? So you might not have thought about it, but I'm sure you are doing it. But all those concepts for me like come from watching people ride the trail and watching myself ride. You know, I try to analyze myself, and when I know the trail by heart, obviously I mean I'm attacking more, so I'm a bit lower because I know what's coming. So like the concept of like your attack position and your more neutral position. Your neutral position is more what's comfortable when you're on your bike. So you're standing tall, you know, you drop your heels, your legs are mostly straight, like almost straight. Your hips are on the back, but not overly on the back. And you've got your arms in a strong position. And that's a position that you can hold on for basically for a while you ride downhill. And that's a position that I think is really good when you go slow and when you don't know the trail, because that allows you to look ahead a bit more. And To pick up the best line and be able to react, you need to be able to scan the terrain. And scanning the terrain means that you look really close to your front wheel and you look far. You look far to know what's coming, make sure you get the best line and prepare yourself to react on what's directly in front of you. And so that neutral position is something that I ride most of the time when I don't know the trail. And I think it's something that most intermediate riders don't do enough. Because that really allows you to pick up the best line and you know, be ready for what's coming right in front of you. If it's a drop, if it's a double, a gap, an inside line, an off camber, like all the type of thing can really adapt. And that attack position is, like, obviously, as the name says, it is a much more aggressive position when you get lower on your bike, so your elbows are more out, your hips are further back, you squat a little bit more on the bike. And the idea of that is to have that position that's going to allow you to get some more traction of the tire when you are slowing down, when you are cornering. And, you know, it's a more stable position also when you ride down, like, you know, a rock garden or a bunch of fruits. And so the downside of that is, well, first of all, you get more tired when you do that because you're squatting more and there's more pressure on your hands, on your legs. But also, since your back is in a flatter position, I guess lower down because your hips are further back and your elbows are lower down, naturally you look even more in the front of you and it's harder to look red. And so it's, you know, like the tip was really to help people to pick up the best line is make sure you look far ahead enough. And if you're too much in the attack position, obviously that makes it harder. But, you know, riders on the World Cup, they've done 10 practice laps and they know the track by heart. Sometimes they've gone to that track for 5, sometimes 10 years. Like Loic Brunier has been to Mont-Saint-Anne for the past, you know, 10 years. I think he started World Cup in 2013, maybe 2012. So actually 2011, I think, was his first World Cup year. So he's been to Mont-Saint-Anne for the past, you know, 12, 13 years now. And some of the track is the same. So he can literally close his eyes and he knows where to go. So he's in that attack position trying to go as fast as he can. But I bet he's still looking up and down, you know, making sure there is, you know, nothing that has changed. Like maybe some rocks fell into that rut that he wants to go. And if suddenly there is a hazard, you know, he might have to adapt and all that type of stuff. But obviously, you know, he does that for a living and he's, you know, one of the best in the world. But for regular riders and regular viewers, I think it's a really valuable tip.
Yeah, man. So would you recommend, like, say you go into a downhill race, would you recommend you really, like, force yourself on your first practice run to be in more of a neutral position, to be taking that, like, slower approach, more stood up on the bike, like, looking
for sure,
where you're going, finding the lines, yeah?
Yeah, for sure, yeah. Yeah, even if you did a track walk, the first time you actually ride your bike and first time you are on the bike, you can be in an attack position. And if you are, you might miss information on the trails. There might be things that you don't see, whereas if you are standing up, you know, you might have seen a line that you think is best while you're walking the track, but once you actually ride the track and you are in a more neutral position, sometimes you just realize that, oh, actually this was better. Obviously, the more advanced rider you are, the least mistake you make in terms of line choices. Sometimes it's very obvious that, you know, one line is better than the other, at least the first time you're going to do it, because obviously the track changes and, you know, a line that's best on the first practice might become the slowest line, you know, by the time of final. But I think that's the type of stuff that, you know, anyone can work on and that can be really beneficial to help rider progress.
Yeah, it's useful, man. What sort of stuff do people, like, most request from you, or, like, what's the most popular? Are there certain areas that people are always asking you to dig into?
Yeah, suspension settings. It's like something that I actually listened to one with Jordi from Fox, like your podcast. Uh-huh. That was really interesting. Suspension settings, but obviously it's tricky to explain, like, every suspension company is different, but there is common knowledge, you know, like the yeah. ways that high speed compression works and like what it does and what low speed compression does is going to be the same whereas you on DVO, RockShox or Fox, like it's the same idea, same with the volume spacer. So I think for people with suspension settings, you know, it's difficult to explain, but it's more having an understanding of what does what.
Yeah.
So, you know, you understand that if you find that your bike dives too much from your front, then it's understanding what parameter can improve that. And then, you know, the better you become, you realize that it's not just your front suspension. It could also be like the height of your bars or how set up your rear shock. Could also be your riding position, obviously. It could be your line choices. Like, there's so much more than just the actual suspension, and you have to make sure that you understand that the bike and yourself, you work as a team, and it's not just one component that works by itself. So suspension setting is very common.
Yeah.
How to do drops is very common as well. Obviously, that's tricky to explain. Every drop is different, you know. Line choices, drops, corners, but
yeah.
corners also is different, and everybody's got a different technique of cornering. Even on the World Cups, I think that's pretty cool to see. Like some riders have different styles. I think that's the main thing. Tire pressure
yeah.
comes back a lot. But I think with all of that is understanding that there's no perfect answer. It's you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to personal preference and how you ride. You know, some riders have you know, preferences on the bikes that doesn't suit another rider of the exact same level.
Yeah.
And you have to
beast.
Yeah, I think you have to, if you understand how the bike works, you can make your own decision for yourself and find a setup that makes you, you know, the most comfortable and also can sort out issues, right? Like one of my friends got wrist issues. So he rides a setup that is probably not optimal for him, but yeah. because he's got wrist issues, then it does make sense. You know, if that makes sense.
That's cool, man. And it's cool that there's so many repositories of information around on the internet now, podcasts, YouTube, all this kind of stuff to help people, like, at least point them in generally the right direction. They still got to go out and ride and do the learning, I guess. But like, yeah, there's a lot of information for people that are looking to improve and fix things and change stuff on their bike. So it's cool, man. So what's next for you, Remy? Like, where do you see things heading? Obviously, you've got a solid bunch of brands that you're working with. The channel seems to be going real well. Like, where do you see it all heading in the next couple of years?
I'll keep on going as long as I enjoy it, really.
Uh-huh.
I think that's the main thing. As long as I'm happy doing it and, you know, I enjoy writing and I enjoy producing content, I'll keep on going. As far as the brand I work with, you know, obviously I'm very happy with everybody. I think they're a great relationship, and that's so that I look forward to keep on going for, you know, as long as I can bring value. At some point, you know, I'm sure that they will tell me that, you know, I'm a bit old. And you know, as of now, it works well and I'm stoked. And I'll probably at some point, you know, move towards more like a product development role. I feel like I've got the knowledge and the understanding. And I mean, I already do it more with some brands than some others, but you know, I'm always chatting with the brands on what I think could improve the product.
Yeah.
Whereas it's, you know, clothing, glasses, knee pads, you know, bike, obviously, suspensions, brakes, you know, tires, like absolutely everything. Every time I've got a feedback, whereas it's, or whether it's, you know, something that I really like, that I think they should maybe develop to other product in the range. You know, that could be, you know, I don't know, let's say Propane has made something on their e-bike that I particularly enjoy. I'll make sure to tell them that this is really something that I think is beneficial and that should be on every bike moving forward. Yeah. So yeah, that's something that I'll I think I can bring a lot of value for that. And brands, you know, always wanting to improve the product. So something that I'll do more and more in the future. As far as content, I think it's, you know, as long as people enjoy what I'm doing, I'll keep on going this way. I don't think at this point in my career, I want to change drastically. You know, the type of content, just I don't think it would make much sense. But I still want to push my riding. Like I want, every time I go on my bike, I want to become a better rider. So I'm always like focusing on, and it's always easier to do when you have weakness. So, you know, there's some types of corners that I, you know, have weakness on. And, you know, when I ride a trail that can highlight those weaknesses, like I can make sure that I'm going to try to work on my body position and, or, you know, just the way how, or just the way I corner really to make sure I improve that. Same on the gym, same on, you know, line choices and all that type of stuff. So I'm always trying to get better. And I think the video are going to keep getting more interesting as I try to explain that as well.
Yeah, it's awesome, man. It's good to see that like everyone is still learning. There's always room to improve. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time, man. But while we've got you here, I'm keen to ask your advice, like, for people that are maybe like starting out working with brands that's got, like maybe it's their first sponsors for racing, or maybe they're building a little channel or whatever it happens to be, like what advice would you give people to help make those relationships as long lasting and as good as they can be?
Well, in a relationship, like communication is key, but that's communication obviously, you know, with the fans, but also with the people you work with. So, you know, being able to communicate properly is, you know, a skill that's absolutely essential. And, you know, communicating means like keeping the partners updated on, you know, what are the plans, the results, new videos that you would have done, but also, you know, with product order, trying to be structured on, you know, when you send an email and ask for something, making sure that you make it as easy as possible for the person to that's behind the screen to help you. Making sure that if you experience an issue with the product, and, you know, obviously that happens to everything, but that you can report it in a constructive way that can help the brand to, you know, it could just be like the brand has made a mistake with the product, or you actually brought to, you know, the absolute limit and you experienced some damage that maybe shouldn't have happened, or simply there is a manufacturer issue with one of the batch that happened also. And I think it's just the way you send a message that's very important. Making sure that, you know, everything always comes politely and respectfully. Those are common sense and pretty basic. Whereas you're trying to be a pro rider, or, you know, work at a bike shop, or, you know, work in finance, or whatever. But I think it's an important skill, and the people who have the longest lasting relationship probably excel on that, because your riding is only gonna give you opportunity while you ride fast. But if you have like a low year and, you know, you struggle with something, if your communication was never great and people don't enjoy working with you, then the relationship are not going to go very far.
Yeah, good advice, man. Sound advice. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure catching up and finding out a bit about what you've been up to and picking your brains on a few things. If people want to follow you over the coming years, where's the best places for them to be looking these days?
Like social media, with, you know, Instagram is definitely where I post the most stuff. But also for people within the industry, like LinkedIn or LinkedIn, I don't know how you pronounce it, but like Facebook for professional, I try to, you know, keep in touch people with what's, you know, more like brands and partner related. And obviously YouTube is a big one. That's, I try to post weekly and I try to make sure that the content is going to be beneficial for the bike community in general.
Awesome, man. Yeah, there's loads of super interesting stuff on there, loads of helpful stuff. So people should definitely check it out. I'll stick links to all of that in the show notes. But yeah, thanks, Rami. It's been a pleasure, man. I hope the rest of the year goes injury free and you have some good times on surfboards, skis and bikes. And yeah, we'll catch up again at some point in the future, man.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time. And yeah, looking forward to have the podcast there.
Nice one. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for this episode with Remy. I really hope you've enjoyed it. Don't forget that the podcast could really benefit from your support right now. That could be via a regular donation at patreon.com/downtimepodcast, by grabbing yourself some merch from downtimepodcast.com/shop, by sharing the episodes with your friends or online, or by subscribing to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/@downtimepodcast and sharing the videos some love with likes and comments to help the channel grow. Stay connected by following the podcast. You can hit that button in your podcast app now or visit downtimepodcast.com/follow. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook too, where we're at Downtime Podcast. And for your extra dose of downtime, sign up to our newsletter at downtimepodcast.com/newsletter. All right, that's it for today. We're going to have another awesome episode coming up really soon. But until next time, get out and ride.